TNT Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox, lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome. We're into the second hour here at TNT. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. And, before Miles in the first segment, we were talking about this whole chemical weapons thing in Ukraine. By the way, great segment by Miles of Truth, bringing that Canadian issue, that euthanasia issue, to the fore on that. I think we had a pretty productive discussion. It's a good bookend to the interview that we did with journalist Jackie DeVoy on Friday. And again, if you missed that Friday segment, it was absolutely powerful and impactful. You can listen to that on the archives. Just go to TNT radio.live, and then you go on to each show and you'll see the listen back archive section just below. Whatever show that is, your favorite host, your favorite show. For ours, you can find Jackie's interview there. In the sort of lineup from Friday, powerful segment, absolutely powerful segment, talking about midazolam and this kind of the end of life COVID industry that sprung up, ventilators, all of it. What a scam. So heads should roll really on that. So one thing I want to talk about is obviously the Ukrainian story. We'll continue that discussion tomorrow. There's going to be some big developments on that front in the next couple of weeks, I'm told. As the 2024 election starts to creep up, pretty much campaigning is going to begin on that in April 2024. And on the Republican GOP side, all sorts of people are going to jump in there, various and sundry war hawks. And so the debate, how this is going to go is pretty predictable. On the Republican side, they're probably going to flood the field with 10 plus candidates. Half of them will be auditioning for a vice presidential slot, and you'll have sort of two to three bona fide front runners. Donald Trump being one of them. Ron DeSantis will probably enter later, but he'll also be one of those front runners. And then the rest are just auditioning for cabinet posts or just to beef up their own political CV. Certainly Mike Pompeo is a deep state candidate. I think he's a shoo-in for vice president in the same way Dick Cheney was for the Bush Jr. Presidency back in 2000. So it's widely understood that Dick Cheney was the one running the government, running foreign policy, running the war on terror, the Iraq war, etc. Not Bush was the figurehead. I think you'd have the same sort of thing, even with the DeSantis presidency. The Republicans tend to be good on domestic issues, but clueless on international ones, whereby they fall prey to the John Boltons of the world, to the intelligence services, feeding them fake intel reports, getting them to do things with the U.S. military to react to threats that aren't necessarily there. This is how that machine basically functions, not just for Republicans, but for Democrats as well. To a large degree, that's also part of the equation. But as the campaigning comes closer, then there's certain issues that are going to become debatable. And one of them will be the nuance of how to wind up the Ukrainian conflict. And so candidates will be jockeying for position on that. Certainly populist candidates going to be, you know, trying to get out of a quagmire, to get out of entangling alliances, pull the country away from a World War II confrontation, World War III in this case, style confrontation. That's what the populist candidate will be. So my guess is that will be a Trump position. He'll say, as he's saying already on social media, I could end this in a week. Just elect me president. I'll bring it to an end. So that creates a competition in that idea space between candidates. So there'll be others mimicking that position or slightly nuanced. We need to be tough. We need a big build up our military. We need to build up hypersonic missiles to counter what Russia has, etc. Star Wars, space warfare, satellite warfare. These are the sort of talking points that are going to sort of fester during that situation. So the thing you have to understand is, if you look at geopolitics and politics full stop through the lens of U.S. domestic politics, and you can get a very accurate read on how international issues are going to be dealt with during an election cycle. And certainly, there's definitely not an appetite for a major war with the U.S. public, although there is in the media, but not necessarily with the public. I think voters reflect that consistently from each term to the next. However, what it does is create a competition. So for the incumbent Democrat White House, if you have the entire Republican field talking about ways to de-escalate or different solutions to avoid a war, that's going to create a differentiation in the political marketplace of ideas with the Democrats if they're not also pursuing de-escalation or reducing tensions rather than raising them. So, and this will affect a change in policy for the National Security Council on the Biden side, and the president itself. If he's still there, he might not be there by the summer. He might have shifted him out by then and brought in somebody else, who knows, be a resignation or some sort of dramatic scandal like the document scandal, etc. We don't know how that's going to play out, but think of Richard Nixon. All you need is a Watergate sideshow to do what the deep state really wants, was to put somebody else in power who's completely supine and compliant. That's certainly what Gerald Ford was. That's what, how, that's why and how that all happened, as was very accurately explained by Tucker Carlson a couple weeks ago. And that was certainly a shocker for a lot of people. However, that leads us to the Chinese balloon story. The Chinese balloon story is interesting because this is very revealing. This tells you the state of American politics. Look at the national reaction to this. And the only thing you can conclude from that is complete high clown world. It's complete high clown world. It's a balloon. Okay, you remember through the Cold War, there were U-2 planes shot down between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. In one case, there was a U.S. Air Force navigation aircraft, which was shot down, I believe, over North Korea. I believe shot down by the North Koreans. This is probably around, say this was either right before or right after the Korean War. I have to check my notes. Had 20 U.S. servicemen, navigators on board. And I believe this was after. Yeah, it was definitely after. This would have actually been, might have been during the Nixon administration. Yeah, so this would have been in the 60s. So 20 U.S. airmen on board. And the reaction from the government was, the U.S. government is, we're not going to escalate. We don't want to turn this into, it was a mistake. The U.S. maintained that it didn't encroach on North Korean airspace, and that was that. Nixon wasn't going to escalate. So this is what happened, and it's 20 U.S. airmen dead. So here you have a balloon, okay? A balloon, it's not armed with anything. Who knows what it is? And you have this massive national freakout. So the U.S. as a public, as the media, as body politic, they can't even process a Chinese balloon. When I say process, they can't put it in its proper perspective. You have to remember, during the Open Skies Treaty, which just recently been wound down between Russia and the U.S., gave overflight rights to both the U.S. to fly over Russian territory and vice versa for Russia to fly over U.S. territory to conduct surveillance of nuclear sites. Okay, that was the Open Skies Treaty. And nobody batting an eyelid. You didn't hear the neocons screaming. Lindsey Graham wasn't screaming about it. Okay. It was just the way it was done. That was the balance of power. And that nuclear doctrine of mutually assured destruction, the MAD doctrine, in a funny way, not in a funny way, in a logical way, that helped to stabilize relationships between two superpowers through various bilateral agreements like the Open Skies Treaty. So that stood for, you know, a long time, 70 years. something like that. And then all of a sudden we have this Chinese balloon. Everyone's freaking out, the CCP, and oh, look, Xi's brazen. He's playing on Biden's weakness. Look what he's done. He sent a balloon over the country. This is laughable at best, laughable at best. And yet this is where we're at. It is truly a low point. And the obvious reaction would be to capture it. This is what the Chinese would do if it was a U.S. balloon. It's what the Russians would do. They would apprehend it, they'd bring it down, and they'd study it. And they'd download or analyze whatever data or intelligence or find out what's being broadcast. In fact, they'd do it covertly so that they wouldn't even give media attention to it. They would just deal with it and be able to track the data and where it's going. And then all sorts, there's a lot of things you can do with this. Biden, under pressure, decided to send up a missile on it. I mean, imagine shooting a missile at a balloon. How stupid is this? But this is where we're at. We're demanding ridiculous, stupid things that actually aren't even advantageous from a counterintelligence or, you know, international intelligence gathering perspective. I mean, a lost opportunity just to make a big show on the media and everyone can beat their chest. They shot a balloon down. How pathetic. Do you think the Chinese are laughing right now? I think they are. And that's the saddest part of it all. Let's take a break here with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stick around. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan.
It's an extremely important topic, and it's actually, well, in my opinion, probably your opinion too, it's more important than trying to put blame on soldiers at the bottom. We need to work out where accountability starts and stops. And I know that you and I would have been taught at our officer's school that is the one thing that real leaders do, is they take responsibility. It may have been things that they, you know, which were hard. Just stop. I totally get that. But that's the point of getting paid the big bucks. That's the point of wearing the, you know, that gold braid on your shoulder, is that you have broad shoulders. And when things don't go right, even if it's, if people like you more, not that's why you do it, but if you say, I'm going to take responsibility for this, that's a leader. That is what you do. And you're right to say that in the Australian Army, we're seeing to have the opposite point of view. If they can possibly say, it wasn't me, they will.
McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks. Welcome back. We're into the second hour of this live broadcast, and we are streaming out live globally, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining us. We're going to connect in a few minutes. We're actually going to bring Matthew Wrestle-Lee back on the show. He's got some updates for us on the legal front there from the federal court, the Southern District of New York. As you might know by now, Matthew's our legal correspondent. He's in and out of that courtroom every day. He's absolutely on top of everything. He's actually pushing the envelope on filing to unseal. So doing what real journalists do. And we're very pleased to have him on our team and giving us these sort of updates, very valuable updates on these really important, impactful stories there. We'll bring him on the line in a couple of minutes. And I think that's going to be interesting what he's got for us this time. But in terms of Back to the Ukraine thing, and I'm going to nail this point home because I think it's super important, okay? And the point is this. There's an ethical component to any war in the field of politics, and one of them is the metric is usually, there's two important metrics. One is dead civilians, and the other is dead soldiers. Now, I think the latter is more important in this conversation because we are actively told by our governments to get behind the war, to support the war effort. They're wanting to create a World War II type of a social atmosphere to back the good fight in Europe and do so by getting the public on board with their support. They got everybody wearing pins, you know, putting Ukrainian flags on their social media platforms and constant, you know, fundraisers. I was just in on British, flying British Airways, and some of these other airlines do it as well. They pass the bucket for Ukraine. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Like they need any money. Our government's just printing up billions of dollars and dumping it into various bank accounts over there, and, you know, to defense contractors in the West. That's where most of the money goes anyway. It just goes into the defense industry. But they're wanting to get us all behind, get us on board with the war effort. Now, there's a thing called the Vietnam War over a 10-year period, you know, roughly speaking, 1963 to 73, few plus or minus, roughly 56,000 U.S. servicemen killed over that 10-year period. You know, that's a big psychological number. We said this on the show before. When you start getting casualties or dead soldiers, you know, eclipsing those types of numbers, getting up there 50,000 plus, that registers very heavily in the minds of American voters. And it seemed like at that point, you know, you got to think about winding it down. 10 years was enough in Vietnam. Certainly, those images of the dead soldiers on the evening news, that's the beginning of the end of the war when the media started reporting on it. So ditto with the situation in Ukraine. Nobody's talking about the casualties. This has been a verboten topic. It's not allowed to be reported by the U.S. media. Why is that? You'd think that would be the first thing to be reported. No, it's being completely buried. And it's illegal to report these numbers in Ukraine, believe it or not. The state have made all other media outlets illegal by law. Only ones that are under state supervision are allowed to broadcast, and they're not allowed to broadcast casualty numbers. It's illegal. So if you're a journalist in Ukraine, so-called fledgling democracy, and you talk about how many dead soldiers there are, you could then be, well, who knows what could happen to you, but it's probably not going to be a good outcome. So this is the situation in Ukraine right now, whereby, and we've posted this interview with former Trump advisor, Colonel Douglas McGregor, on 21st Century with former Fox News analyst, Judge Andrew Napolitano. And this is a really crucial segment because McGregor talks about what he thinks are the true numbers. And the numbers he's posting here are staggering, okay? This is well above 100,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers. So you have to understand what you're talking about there. That's beyond the psychological barrier of any American, and probably well above what any Europeans would tolerate in terms of, you know, backing a war that's a losing war, and B, that's turned into a human meat grinder. It's untenable ethically and morally, even by today's technocratic, you know, anodyne, anesthetized European electorate standard. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll play a little bit of this clip with Judge Napolitano and Colonel Douglas McGregor. And I think it's very telling because it's going to give you a little bit of an insight into where things are in terms of this conflict. So this is Colonel Douglas McGregor and Andrew Napolitano. Judge Napolitano is asking the questions during this segment, and McGregor is giving his honest assessment as to where things are at and where he thinks the U.S. government and NATO really should be going on this issue. But let's listen to this.
Regionally or globally. So can you weigh in on these two statements? Why would generals be leaking that they don't want to fight? Are we militarily and from an equipment perspective incapable of fighting Russia today in Ukraine or anywhere else?
Well, I don't know about the leaking bit. Depends on who you talk to. I'm simply saying that based upon my sources in the Department of Defense, people who are close to the senior military leadership tell me that they have made it very clear that choosing to fight Russia in Ukraine would be a serious mistake and should be avoided. That's what they've said. And I think they're being honest about that. And I think they're being truthful for a change. The second part is, are we capable of fighting? Well, of course we're capable of fighting. The real question is, if you're going to fight, will you win? And this is the question that people don't ask enough. This goes back to an old strategic axiom. Measure what you might gain by what you might lose. A collision with Russia would be a loss for us. There's nothing to be gained by it. The Russians have nothing that we need or want. There's no ideological hostility. We're not competing for power or control over any particular region. Russia's dispute is exclusively with Ukraine. We're a large part of the reason why the dispute exists. There's no question about that. But we can end that tomorrow morning if we decide to by simply saying, we fought long enough. Russia has the upper hand. Zelensky, sit down, shut up, and take notes. We must have a ceasefire, but first we have to agree to negotiations without preconditions.
Does Washington want to fight Russia via a proxy war?
I think they did. I think they regret it at this point, to be blunt with you. No one will admit it publicly, but if you go back to the donor conference, where Lloyd Austin spoke to the gathered donors from NATO and other nations and said, we have a very short time left, a very short window of time in which to make things happen. And time is running out. I mean, I quoted him in the op-ed piece for that reason. He knows, everyone in Washington in a position of authority now knows, Ukraine is losing. Ukrainian resistance is crumbling. The state itself is in danger of going out of existence. That's how bad it is. So the theory is, well, if we can give them anything within the next 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 days, perhaps we can rescue them from disaster. I don't see much evidence for that, but I think that's the theory.
Can Ukraine survive as a country if Putin pursues this war all out? Whether for military reasons or for domestic Russian political reasons?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind, this is something of which I was not aware until I consulted with a friend who's done some excellent demographic analysis. And he points out that at the beginning of this war, there were at least in theory 37.5 million Ukrainians in Ukraine. And he makes the point that today that's not the case. There were already 2 million Ukrainians working in either Great Britain or the European Union outside of the country. You now have 4 million Ukrainian citizens, albeit Russians, people who speak Russian, living under Russian occupation or administration right now in the provinces in the south. Then you have over 10 million Ukrainians that have fled the country.
10 million. That's a third of the country or a quarter of the country.
Yeah, you've got 1 million that have gone into Russia and the rest that have headed west. Now, to this must be added the losses. And again, no one is telling us the truth in the West about the horrific losses that Ukraine has taken. You've heard me say about 150, 157,000 dead on the battlefield. That includes 35,000 missing in action, presumed dead. And I've talked about a total of almost 400,000 casualties, people that are wounded. In most cases, not all, but in most cases, more than half of those will never return to duty because the wounds are too horrific. In other words, they're permanently lost to the Ukrainian fight. Now, supposedly when Zaluzhny was in town speaking to Secretary Austin and General Milley, several people have insisted that he actually told them that 257,000 Ukrainians have died. That includes soldiers. In other words, those in uniform, civilians, all types, all kinds, 257,000. Well, we don't know. I mean, that's an unconfirmed rumor. But what it does tell you is that today in Ukraine, there are roughly between 18 and 22 million people left in the country under Zelensky's control.
Wow. So just to tell you the gravity of those figures, that is Colonel Douglas McGregor. He's probably one of the most honest pundits you'll find on military affairs on the U.S. side. That's what he's saying there. I think, you know, 150 to 170,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers. Okay. That's triple Vietnam. 10 years it took to do that in Vietnam. They've done triple that in 12 months, less than 12 months. So at that point, you know, it's a disaster. It shouldn't be going on any further. There is nothing to be won or gained by this conflict other than saving face by Washington and Britain. If you look at who's really been leading the attack on this, it's been Britain. Every time the U.S. has wavered, they send in Ben Wallace or whatever, these various people to keep the war effort going. So in terms of NATO and the chief whip is Britain. McGregor laid it out pretty clear there. It's a disaster for Ukraine. They've been egged on the whole way, sold a pup, promised utopia, same old story. Eventually they'll be abandoned. Okay. They'll be abandoned and the jackals will come in and buy up what's left. Okay. And then Poland will take a piece and Hungary will take a piece and, you know, Russia will hold referendums in Odessa and that will go as well. That's probably where this is going to end up. So just a net loss for Ukraine. They could have avoided it all from day one. Very, very easily. But we're going to try to bring Matt Lee on. He's our legal correspondent. We'll try to catch him on the court steps of the federal court in New York, the Southern District of New York. So what's at the top of the docket this week? I know last week was pretty busy, and thanks for your commentary on Friday, sir. Sure. Certainly that was enlightening, to say the least. How are things shaping up this week?
I guess I'd say that, I mean, on what we've been discussing on each of these broadcasts, Mr. Bankman-Fried saying they're trying to work out a deal. No, not on a guilty plea, but simply on the matter of his conditions of release, whether he can, who he can contact, and whether he can continue to use Signal, but I guess also WhatsApp and any number of other applications. So I don't know if that will happen. That's why I've decided, I think, the theme this week, or at least at the beginning of the week, is terrorism. And it's not, I didn't choose it, but there seems to be a slate of federal terrorism charges cases over here. But late last week, a husband and wife team, James Bradley and Arwa Muthanna, who's kind of famous, her family is famous. Her father was a Yemeni diplomat. And she was charged, along with James Bradley, who she married, with trying to go to Yemen and join ISIS. I may have mentioned that on Friday. She was charged, along with James Bradley, who she married, with trying to go to Yemen and join ISIS. I may have mentioned that on Friday, but it made me think. They were sentenced last week. First, on one day, James Bradley got 11 years. This was a lot of time. They didn't actually ever leave the United States, but it was, the evidence made it pretty clear they were trying to do that. And on Friday, Arwa Muthanna got 9 years. But there's a guy that they're treating much more seriously, although just as in the first two cases, nothing actually happened. There's a U.S. soldier called Ethan Melzer, who it's a wild case. He linked up online. It seems like he was kind of an isolated. He said he had a very tough childhood in Kentucky. He's an all-American boy, but through the wonders of the internet and I guess what they're calling radicalization, he saw fit to share online the logistics and deployment of his team with the stated goal of having them be attacked, killed, and sparking a new war in the Middle East. That was his goal.
Well, is a soldier?
He played guilty.
Is it
he's a soldier, yes.
So a U.S. soldier?
Melzer's his name.
Wow.
Ethan Melzer. He was a U.S. soldier that was accused of joining a very kind of shadowy, it's kind of an apocalyptic cult. It's funny, it's not, the allegation isn't ISIS. It's that he got, there's a lot of, people talk about the dark web, but this is about the darkest web I've ever seen, in that he literally was at least for a time, and that his lawyers now, I'll tell you about the numbers being bandied around in a moment. As you might imagine, they're substantial. his lawyers say he just lost his mind temporarily. It was he's since then, he's ashamed that he was trying to get his own unit killed. But I think what makes it such an extraordinary case is the goal of it. Well, it wasn't like he was joining another. It was a meta goal. It wasn't like I'm in the U.S. Army, but I'm secretly working with the Taliban or ISIS. It was I'm in the U.S. Army, and I want to spark it's like trying to spark a race war. But in this case, I guess he thought if his unit was attacked, it would draw the U.S. into more war. If you see what I mean. So it was kind of the motivation is wild. The government wants 45 years. And the defense, unlike in the James Bradley case where they asked for no time at all or time served, the defense is saying we acknowledge he has to get 15 years. I guess it's the mandatory minimum. I mean, it's an extraordinary crime. Let's put it that way. It's much worse than a husband and wife trying to join ISIS in Yemen. Kind of a romantic terrorism plot. This one's a totally wild plot, and he's definitely going to do 15. I guess the over under would probably be somewhere around 30 for this. So I'll pause there. I don't know what your thought. It's funny that this case didn't get more play because it's totally wild. Maybe they just don't want to hype it up. Sort of how he was literally like at a U.S. Army base in Italy. Putting together information about how his unit could be attacked once they deployed to Turkey. They were going to Turkey. I'm assuming they were kind of one of these units that goes to Turkey and then does some incursions into Syria, where I think we both have to know there's been a terrible earthquake and I'm sure the UN is going to try to rip off aid money, but I'm sure there's some serious aid people, and I wish them well and hope that things can, people can be saved from these rubble of buildings and stuff.
Wow. So this, wow. This is just about as good, Matthew, as a Hollywood script. So Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, that there have been nuclear armed munitions in that air base. It's a Cold War air base, part of the U.S. strategic structure for the Cold War against Soviet Union, but missiles too, possibly at one point. I don't know about now, but then it's also staging ground for the proxy war in Syria, supporting the Syrian Kurdish Democratic Forces, so-called, and also supporting the jihadis in Idlib. So NATO's still involved in Syria. So, but this is extraordinary, Matthew, because what you're saying is that he would have been motivated by an end of times, let's say, Christian eschatological narrative of accelerating the end times. So is that what it is?
Yes, it's a very strange group, but yes, I think that summarizes it pretty well. And I think it's strange because it's a different, it's really like that. I was calling it meta, but it's a kind of like a two stages up. I guess maybe from the government's point of view, that kind of motivation is even more frightening, if you see what I mean. Like, you can understand, it's like someone I'm thinking in the civil rights era, someone trying to trigger a race war. Like, it's doing an act, cynically, strategically, to create other effects, as opposed to just saying, I've watched this imam. You know what I mean?
It seems
more devious somehow.
It sounds like something the U.S. government would want to do, actually.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe that's why they kind of regret it. Who knows what they'll do once they put him away for that amount of time. I have to say, I have two more terrorism cases, but you mentioned Hollywood, and that's also on the docket here. I don't know if people are going to ever have heard of this guy. I hadn't until the case came down the pike. A self-described, and he did work on a few films. A Hollywood producer named Dylan Jordan was indicted about a year and a half ago for basically pimping. He was a Hollywood producer, but he somehow had a side business of procuring women for affluent businessmen. And at the time that they were fighting it out, he got a very, very experienced, private counsel, that has a lot of money. And they tried to, I even misunderstood it when he was negotiating the plea, that he was setting up parties and he got charged as a pimp. I learned only Friday from the government sentencing memo that he was arrested previously at age 29 in Cuba and served 8 years in Cuban prison for promoting prostitution of underage girls in Cuba. So he's quite a Hollywood script himself. And Here's the thing I find strange about that case is that he's pled guilty and he's facing sentencing, and he says he's spent enough time. The government somehow gave him a plea deal where his maximum sentence is 5 years. Now, this seems strange to me because, I guess if it's because of the allegation of underage victims in the Cuban case, I guess they must have really vetted out his American business and he was just being very careful, because 5 years seems kind of light for if Ghislaine Maxwell got 20 years, I don't know why Hollywood Dylan Jordan has a maximum of five, which means he'll probably get less. This, too, is coming up in the SDNY.
Wow, that's interesting. Wow. That's interesting. I wonder if he's connected with Jeff Epstein, or if the black book that he was procuring on behalf of had some very important names in it. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. And certainly that.
And maybe let's go down that route. Maybe that's why he's getting such a light deal to not open his black book. Anyway, I'm going to definitely cover the sentencing and see what's happening with Mr. Dylan Jordan. But back to terrorism. Let's hit
terrorism. Let's take a break real quick on the 40-minute mark here with TNT. We'll come back. I'm with Matthew Lee on the steps of the Southern District of New York Federal Court, and we've got the terrorism docket coming up. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back after these messages.
Whatever happened to the 1970s Volvo driving Save the Whale liberals? Well, they're not saving the whales today.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
As beach whales unexplainably continue to appear on East Coast beaches in the United States, one culprit has been identified. Massive new offshore wind development and testing has been taking place off the coast, potentially interfering with the sonar of the whales. There have now been multiple calls to halt the offshore wind development pending a further investigation. These giant majestic animals are unexplainably appearing dead on the beach. There's now a lawsuit pending to save the right whale from offshore wind development in Virginia. But so far, environmental groups have remained largely, completely silent. Why? Because wind power is a politically protected energy system, part of the climate agenda. Environmentalists can say nothing that would cross the Democratic donor base and the green energy investment structure. Let's hope liberals wake up and return to the Volvo driving Save the Whale days before it's too late. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Here's a fun fact for you. The average chameleon can point their eyes in two different directions. On the other hand, the average human can't. So unless you're a chameleon, there's absolutely no way you can focus on texting and driving at the same time. So don't do it, unless you're a chameleon.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in the final stretch of the second hour here on TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us on the live broadcast. And on the phone right now, we're in touch with Matthew Lee from Inner City Press. He's joining us now in the Southern District of New York Federal Court. And there's a number of interesting cases. I mean, the last one pretty much blew my mind, Matthew. More on that. That'll be something I'd like to hear more about as it develops. Sure. But on that, you said there's a whole spate of terrorism cases that
we've done three or two, depending if you package the couple together. Got at least three more. I'm going to leave the big one for the end because I don't know how we made it. It's very serious. There's a guy here facing extremely rare federal death penalty for mowing down people on a bike path, largely tourists, in 2017. His name is Saifullo Saipov from Uzbekistan. But today, as it happens, I didn't know this literally until I came in today, there was an incident here in New York City on New Year's Eve in Times Square where people go to see the ball drop. It's not, I have to say, if anyone's thinking of coming to do it, don't do it, because you get penned in and you can't leave, and it's like a whole nightmare. I think this gentleman, his name is Travis Bickford. He's a 19-year-old Caucasian man from Maine. He came down and he attacked three policemen at the sort of perimeter of Times Square's celebration with a machete while screaming Allahu Akbar. So he's been in state custody since then, but they've now filed federal terrorism charges, and he's going to be presented, I believe, at 1 o'clock. I said the moment that we get off this here this time, broadcast in magistrate's court. So I'm quite curious to see how he's faring and why. I mean, obviously, it's a big country. You're going to have radicalization, but at least two of these cases have been, including the soldier with the end of times analysis, and then this guy from Maine coming down to Times Square to yell Allahu Akbar and raise a machete at the police, who all went were hospitalized, but no one was killed. I think he's going to get a significant time for that, pretty clearly. But again, innocent until proven guilty, okay? It's all on video, but he did yell that, and there it is.
This is a weird one, Matthew, because this has happened before, and it just seems counterintuitive, even from a sort of burgeoning jihadi perspective, to sort of, you know, it's always New Year's Eve or sort of some high-profile Christmas marketplace, and then, you know, charging with a kitchen knife, shouting Allahu Akbar is probably a good way to get shot, for one, if not just get beaten to a pulp by bystanders. What you hope to achieve by that, but what I've found, and I don't know if you're familiar with this book, but it's to me one of the most important pieces of literature ever produced in the sort of crime genre, which is called The Terror Factory by Trevor Aronson, who reported on counterterrorism cases during the whole war on terror. And a large percentage, more than 50% of all the high profile terrorist busts in America during the war on terror years, up to when that book was published, I believe it was 2016, featured FBI paid informants and handlers that were operating on the periphery. And sometimes this comes up in the court case, Matthew, but sometimes it doesn't. And that's, but this book is has never been challenged. And he's a credible mainstream journalist. He's not part of the blogosphere fringe or anything. And he's shown an absolute pattern where the FBI will come up and announce these high profile buster cases that when you find out by the time the legal process is expended, all of the connections become exposed to actual FBI run terror cells. It's happened so many times. And
absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I mean, again, I'm going to take it down. I'm not sure it's even as some of these counterterrorism units can just have too much time on their hands. And I say that because I covered a kind of very sad case here of a guy called Delawar Hussein.
I heard about that one.
I think what I didn't hear about that is that the guy, it was big. Did you know that when he went to JFK to try to fly, I guess, to Pakistan and get into Afghanistan and join the Taliban, that he had lube and women's designer jeans in his suitcase? He was basically looking for a wife. He was stoked up into this. It was a very mixed motive. I want to join the Taliban, and also, like, I'm hot under the collar and want to find, like, you know, like jihadi love. It was a very weird. And I sat in the courtroom. I want to say people have heard of this case, and no one was there. I was the only journalist covering the trial. His parents were sitting in the front row talking to his federal defenders. And it seemed to me, my read on that case is that he was kind of entrapped. There was a confidential source who was like, you know, maybe you can. I mean, and I'm sure that definitely that's a way that ISIS, you know, recruits people, is to say, like, not only can you, like, behead people, but you're also going to have all these women in rock stars. Ever. But this was even sadder because it was just that one detail. I think I even put it in the headline of my story, the terrorist with lube in his suitcase. It was just wild. And this guy's came up. Actually, he was somehow part of the James Bradley and Arwa Mathana case. They were all planning together to, like, get on a container ship from Newark. Some of these cases are much less than what they seem, you know, like, and so I think it's not only, like, on the other hand, what I was going to say is I thought we were going to go with it is the idea. I was going to, I'm sorry to say, take a kind of a racial analysis, not racial, racial ethnic analysis, that it probably would. If you were ISIS, which I'm not, but if you were, it would seem more frightening to Americans to recruit sort of like their own youth to do these things than to have like a man named Saiful Saipov who came from Uzbekistan, who's driving an Uber. Because then it makes, at least the government can say, well, look, you know, if we take a kind of an anti-immigrant, we can like monitor all people from some countries, like a certain ex-president wanted to do. But if it can be just like a high school student from Maine, how does that happen, right? So I think, I don't know what's going to, it's going to be curious to me. And the problem with these cases is that when people plead guilty, you really don't find out what was behind it. Oh, you need a trial for that. And like 90% of the cases plead out. So it's that helps the government in terms of if they were entrapping people, it all goes away very quietly.
No, you're right. Yeah. That is the big tragedy is when they plead out the discovery. Those are important, you know, facts. Here's a good case. This was a classic case. This was in 2015. Mm-hmm. And there seemed to be a lot of these under the Obama administration for some reason. They're just happening thick and fast. Maybe that had to do with the war in Syria, and this helped to justify the foreign policy. But his name was Christopher Lee Cornell. He was a high school wrestler, and he got mm-hmm. caught up. He became a Muslim convert, white Anglo-Saxon, regular guy, small town in Ohio. And then they did a high profile bust outside of a gun shop where he was on his way to DC, and the FBI then, you know, nabbed him, and they went national with the story and the American ISIS and convert, and he was radicalized online. It turns out that he was basically being run by an FBI informant, and they gave him the mm-hmm. money to go into the shop, and they're waiting for him when he came out with the weapons or whatever. I mean, the whole thing was totally staged. And so he was radicalized. It looks like he was part radicalized, at least by his FBI handler. So mm-hmm. that's just one example. And then that begs the question, of course, Matt, is, you know, if the FBI wasn't involved, would we even be seeing this happen? That's the big question.
I want to say, I think I'm willing to, the one good thing about the Saipov, I mean, there's nothing very good about it, but this is the one that I was holding back until now. This is it actually has gone to trial. And the reason it's entirely clear that this is also not a matter of sort of like entrapment and being caught in the gun store or in Newark trying to get onto a ship. Legitimately, this happened in New York City. I remember it even, I think in 2017, I was still in the UN, so I wasn't covering the court the way I am now. It was before I was roughed up and thrown out of the UN. So, but I was aware of this. Some downtown, they were like, whoa, a rented Home Depot pickup truck has pulled off the West Side Highway in Lower Manhattan. This is like right near, quote unquote, Ground Zero. It's literally like in Lower Manhattan, there's a highway, and then there's a very wide bike path, wide enough for once a pickup truck came off the highway, he just ran fast down. He killed 8 people on bikes, and he injured some 18 and ended up crashing into a school bus. And then I've seen this video because it's come out at trial. He jumped out of the car with a gun and was like firing at the police. So he was legitimately, and I think I didn't hear anything. There's been 2 stages of this trial, and the second stage starts on February 13th, and that's the death penalty phase. The first one was liability. And I don't really, it seemed strange to me that you always have a right to a trial, but he said it when he was arrested after the police shot him, but they didn't kill him. He was in the hospital, and his first request, and I do believe this, was whether he could post an ISIS flag on the wall of the hospital room. But here's the, no, I mean, you know, I don't think he came to the U.S. to do this. I don't think it was an implant. He basically got a visa sort of through a kind of a lottery system. He moved to Ohio. I didn't know there was a big Uzbek community there, but he went to Ohio. He became a truck driver for a while, and then finally was an Uber driver based in New Jersey. I think he listened to a lot of audio, and I don't know, you know, again, it's one of these things. He had a wife and 3 children. He just decided it was something he wanted to do. But the motivation is, and this is what the federal defender is, he has free, very smart lawyers trying to keep him from being executed. I don't really know what he wants, because his goal, his stated goal in this, he thought he was going to die. And if you see the video, it seems clear he didn't just want to kill people. Once the car crashed, he jumped out and was like, not even trying to run away. He was kind of running around the highway, shooting in the air. It just so happened that they didn't kill him. But now is the defense that's being put up by the federal defenders is that the death penalty count seems to ride on, it's kind of almost a racketeering, kind of a RICO theory in which, a murder created in order to maintain or increase one's position in a racketeering organization justifies the death penalty. So they got ISIS described as a racketeering organization, which seems like a very benign way to describe them. But technically, they're no different, apparently, than a crack gang or than the Gambino family, because they wanted to use this theory of murder to rise up. I always hear this in these cases. Oh, he did that hit in order to move up, and that's why he should be. But what they're saying is, no, he didn't want to even join ISIS. He was never an ISIS member. He heard about it. When he was arrested, he talked about al-Baghdadi's sermons. But he said explicitly he never wanted to go overseas and fight for ISIS. He heard it, he believed in it, and he wanted to die. So they're saying you can't kill him, ironically, because he wasn't doing it to rise up in the organization. And there's been a lot of money. There was a three-week first stage of the trial. Did he do it or not? And he was found guilty on all 28 counts. Now begins the penalty phase. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about, I don't think the federal defenders are going to say that he was entrapped. They're going to say, you know, this is what it was like growing up in Uzbekistan and a lot of different things. But so it's not a normal trial, but it still is a trial in the sense that they're not contesting the evidence. And I'm sure that there's some discovery we're not seeing, but at least it's being played out over time. I do this with where cases go to that. I'm thinking of, I've begun work on a kind of booklet, not a full book, but like 100 page, something like that, because there's a lot of interesting, some of the things we've discussed here will be in it, but whenever you have a trial and you can look at it day after day and they come in with the exhibits and they cross-examine people, you get enough material. It's kind of like a ready mix project, and it's revealing some interesting things.
That's interesting you said about the death penalty riding on that. So it's like the premeditated stroke racketeering, that sort of crime is it's more pithy, and that you can execute the death penalty through that versus a more, say, religious, emotional, passionate
outburst. I think that's probably the difference. I've honestly been thinking the prosecutors kind of screwed this one up by going with this racketeering theory, because I could imagine the jury saying, yeah, he's a terrible, you know, he didn't do it. If you haven't proved that he did it to rise up within ISIS, he wasn't even a member. So they're going to have experts talking about the way ISIS tries to recruit sort of one-off lone wolf attackers. They're not really, I think it's a real stretch to call them a racketeering organization. I mean, they're definitely an organization, but like, it just seems like a, it's trying to fit this fancy legal theory. And I wonder if this had happened under the Biden administration, if they would have sought the death penalty. You know, I think that their position is that there should be a moratorium, but they can't. This case was begun under the Trump, and they can't take away seeking it. Whether, you know, even if it happened, there'll be a lot of appeals. It's come down to he'll either be executed like 20 years from now or spend the rest of his life in a one room, windowless, underground cell, never leaving it, in Florence, Colorado, which is the U.S. supermax. It's where El Chapo is. And they're basically, that's where they're preparing a spot for him. And it's kind of, he did a terrible thing, but he's kind of a very slight guy with a beard. And when you read his day-to-day existence until like at least the weeks before this thing happened, just a very kind of normal, you know, cab driving, God fearing, whatever that means, man. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's interesting. Yeah. Just to hear the terrorism cases popping up again, because this used to be a daily, weekly occurrence, just a few years ago. And that's what the media was geared towards covering. It was just nonstop mass shooting and domestic terror, or an ISIS terror, Al-Qaeda inspired, ISIS inspired, whatever. So it's interesting, very interesting to see how this is shaping up at this point. And, you know, maybe we can draw some other themes and reflections from this in terms of what's going on geopolitically. I'm sure that's going to come up for discussion as well. But Matthew Russell Lee, thank you very much. Inner City Press, thank you for joining us this week.
Oh, absolutely. No problem. I'll remain on the beat and we'll talk soon.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Lee. And look, thank you to Miles of Truth in the first hour. What an amazing discussion we had on the Canadian euthanasia issue. We'll keep an eye on that one as well. That's a developing story. Look, that's all we've got time for today, folks. So we will leave you now and hand it over to the Jesse Zerwell Show. on the live mix at TNT International. I'm Patrick Hanks, your host. We'll see you in the same time, same place next week. No, tomorrow, actually. Tomorrow with Basil Valentine and Blake Lovewell. Should be fun.